How about now? Now?
Good.
Good. Should I be quiet?
Yes.
The first time we did it, I was scared to death. She snuck out in that cotton dress. Jumped on in and we drove to the lake. Put her hand on my knee and said, I can't wait. I had everything we needed in the bed of my truck. Turns out my baby loves to fish. Won't you do it all the time? Early in the morning, in the middle of the night. She's hooked and now she can't get enough. Man, that girl sure loves to fish.
Welcome to another episode of Fishy Radio. I'm Alex, and as always, we have Dee, Heather, and Jeannie. Girls, say hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
And we have a special guest with us again today. It is Betty Sauger from, she is the Sea Grant agent with the University of Florida and Charlotte County. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Jeannie, did you have any questions that you wanted to ask?
So today's Tuesday, my favorite topic ever, redfish. Today was the release of the up to, quote-unquote, 10,000 redfish that they just announced on Thursday or Friday, I think it was, said that they were releasing up to 10,000 redfish on Tuesday. So that, to me, is exciting. That sounds great. And I was just, I wanted, again, what is your professional opinion on releasing 10,000 redfish into our harbor? And what do you think their survival rates are? How do you think that helps us in your opinion, or does it help us or not help us in your opinion?
Okay, so I don't know a whole lot about, you know, like what size class these fish were.
I think they said they were 7 inches.
7 inches.
Seven
okay.
inches.
Because, you know, you can release at different sizes, and a lot has to do with what's the natural cycle of the fish, at what age should they be right now. That's going to make the most sense to release them at that size. And then what are the genetics of the fish? Where are you releasing the fish? Are you releasing them into suitable habitat?
And can I just ask real quick, what is the size? Like the other two questions, I don't think I know. But what is a good size to release redfish?
So redfish spawn in the late fall. They're, you know, usually around October is when they're headed off to the passes to spawn. Mm-hmm. And they usually grow half inch to an inch per month. So if you do the math, what does that equate to? October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, June, July. So, yeah, that's probably in that ballpark of the size that you would expect to see redfish. You know, my opinion on these types of projects has always been, you know, as long as you think through all of the negatives and work out any potential downfall, like, you know, I mentioned the genetics or the size classes, the habitat, where, you know, those types of variables, as long as you're not causing harm, then you can do, you know, sometimes even if you don't increase the population, you've done a lot for the community and bringing the community together and supporting something and making people feel as though there's a positive. Whether those redfish will survive, I don't know. You know, there's a lot of mortality in redfish as they grow up.
Just naturally.
Yeah, just naturally. So, you know, we know that there's fair amount of recruitment. We're not lacking in Charlotte Harbor in terms of recruitment, but there's not a lot of, when I say recruitment, we're not lacking in terms of eggs and larvae that come into the harbor. But we don't have a lot of survival to where they get to that, like, let's say 5-inch size. Mm-hmm. And so what that bottleneck is, if that is habitat related, water quality related, we don't really know. So maybe the 7 inches was to get over that bottleneck. I don't know. Again, I'm not part of that project, but you know, there's a lot of variables that go into stock assessment. And or stock enhancement. And as long as those variables are thought through carefully, then, you know, and people don't have this unrealistic expectation that we put 10,000 out and 10,000 are going to survive. Because it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, or a red-fishy
Mother Nature is Mother Nature.
Yeah, so, you know, you might get a couple that survive. I'm assuming they're all tagged, so we will probably know. You know, we'll have a fair idea, because if we catch some in the future that have a tag that was part of that release project, then we'll know that there was some successes. Mm-hmm. If you don't catch some, you can't say, you know, and this happens, I do scallop restoration. I put a lot of larvae out there. If somebody catches one of my scallops, I can't, you know, without genetics, I can't say, you know, that was my scallop.
One.
You know, I put that there. So, you know, at least, you know, if we have some tagged redfish, we can have a little bit of science behind it, so to speak.
So when fish are released, do they tag them all? Or
a lot of times they do.
Okay.
I would think these have some kind of tag, whether it's a pit tag, which goes just under the muscle.
Yeah.
And you use a scanner over it, so the people who would be finding those fish would be scientists that have a scanner. And, of course, we're very fortunate in Charlotte Harbor that we have a dedicated group that goes out 5 days a week, pulling seines and trawls, collecting science information. So they would have a scanner, and they would scan the fish and find it. Other times you use the dart tags, which are the ones that you see, and the anglers catch the fish, and they can call a hotline number and let people know. So
I called that hotline number. I caught one of the fish that was released at Ponce.
Oh, awesome!
7 days after it was released, it was... I believe one of 20 fish that were tagged. They were the larger fish. Mine was 28 inches.
Okay.
But
and I never got my T-shirt.
No, you caught one of the fish at Ponce that was released at Ponce 7 days later. Yeah. Like, it didn't go anywhere.
So that is not unusual.
Okay.
I did redfish tagging for 4 years associated with the Kids Cup tournament that took place in Punta Gorda. So we tagged fish from 2007 to 2010. And we were also acoustically tagging them. So we would do, you know, put a tag in the abdominal cavity, and we had an array of receivers located around the release location, but then also throughout the harbor. And what we were finding was with 2 weeks, these fish were just kind of swimming around the release location, and then they would kind of get their orientation, and they would school up a little bit, and they would move out, and then they would come back. And then they would move out a little bit further, and they'd come back, and then pretty soon they'd start moving down the harbor. But they were always moving back and forth in and out of an array, and within a year, they were maybe 5 to 10 miles away from the release location.
Wow.
But
that's so cute. They were scared to go away from
it. Was like their little safe space.
Like,
they
were like, where am I?
That's awesome.
So I'm not surprised that happened, because that was certainly the experience that we saw for 4 years with our tagged redfish.
So with this redfish release, some people argue that we don't have the habitat to sustain 10,000 redfish or 5,000 redfish, whatever might survive out of them. Again, what is your professional opinion on that? How what do you think the health of Charlotte Harbor is in order to sustain more redfish?
I don't know if it's the health of Charlotte Harbor, if it's just, you know, the way the harbor is designed. Charlotte Harbor mirrors Tampa Bay in many regards in terms of redfish. And it's different than, say, Sarasota Bay or some of the smaller estuaries. So if you look at recruitment patterns for, say, Charlotte Harbor and Tampa Bay, and you compare them to areas, let's say, off of Cedar Key or Steinhatchee, the habitat's very different in these estuaries. You have a lot more salt marsh, which is redfish's preferred habitat, whereas here we have more mangroves. And so here we have a lot higher recruitment. We have a lot more eggs and larvae that gets transported into the estuary. but far fewer of them actually recruit to the estuary. So we're losing them between larvae and, let's say, 5 inches. Whereas in the northern part of the state, they seem to have proportionally less eggs and larvae and higher survival.
Is there something that eats them at that small stage?
Probably.
Is there something that's
I mean, and probably each other, too. I mean, there's kind of a space. So if you have too many and not enough resources, not enough food, they're either going to eat each other or other things are going to eat them, or they just starve to death because they don't have the food.
Now, for people that don't know, and we've used the word a lot, but for people that don't know, can you define the word estuary?
Yeah. Sure. So an estuary is anywhere where you have salt water and fresh water mixing together.
Oh.
And so...
That wasn't my guess.
Okay, what was your guess?
Yep.
Uh-oh. Is it going to be that schoolhouse definition of a semi-enclosed body of water?
Yeah.
Mine would have been more like a nursery.
A breeding ground. Yeah. Right.
Okay,
and that fresh water...
So the fresh and the salt water mixing together creates conditions that are very suitable for
to
a nursery. And so it's, you know, you hear different numbers, but it's roughly like 80% of our commercially important fish and invertebrate species spend at least a portion of their time in the estuary. And that's certainly true for redfish, which we have in the estuary from the time the eggs hatch until they're about 3 to 4 years old, at which point they go offshore, join the adult populations, where they spend the rest of their life.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's very important.
So, what makes an estuary more hospitable than a non-estuary?
So, and we talked about this in our
species?
So you have different varieties of habitats. So estuaries, as opposed to being, let's say, offshore of our coast, is kind of a harsh environment. It's very sandy. There's a lot of turbulent mixing. There's less structure, if you will, because it's mostly sand. So inside your estuary, it's a little calmer, and you have more plants that are providing more cover. And so you have mangroves along the fringe, you have seagrasses, you have the bare sediment bottoms, you have different structure depending on where you are that all of these fish and invertebrate species need at certain points in their life. So redfish, just to stay with redfish for instance, redfish, when the eggs get transported into the estuary, they like to settle out in these turbid waters, so they'll settle out usually around river mouths where it's dark. There's a lot of food that's coming out of the river systems, and they can blend in with this dark environment. They may be in the seagrasses or in the mangroves, but they want those dark, murky waters where they can hide. And then as they get bigger, they're going to move out and down the estuary, and they'll kind of hang out in the mangroves and in the seagrasses, but they might move away from those real, I would call them more fresh conditions.
And all of Charlotte Harbor is an estuary?
It is, as well as the Lower Peace and the Lower Myakka. So as long as it's at some point during the year is receiving fresh water and salt water. So in terms of salinity, true fresh water has no salt, so we'd say it's zero. True seawater is somewhere around 32 to 35 parts per thousand salt water. Mm-hmm. An estuary is pretty much anything in the middle.
So typically you said that an estuary is a place where salt water and fresh water meet.
Mm-hmm.
And so is this condition more conducive to maybe things growing? Whether it be plants, mangroves. Is this the reason why they hang around in there?
So in terms of plants, in many cases it's more conducive because it's a calmer environment. Generally, it's usually a shallower environment.
Mm-hmm.
There's more nutrients available to them, and so fish and invertebrates like those environments because they not only have food, because of the nutrients, the high productivity, mm-hmm. but they also have places to hide.
Right.
Are there any freshwater plants or animals that grow up in an estuary and then go back to freshwater?
I can't think of any off the top of my head. Now, we do have species that can move freely between.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
snook is an example of one of those. Snook is urohaline, so it can be in freshwater and it can be in seawater. And sometimes mm-hmm. snook will go up into the Peace River, for instance, and it might not come down. It'll skip going offshore to spawn for a season, because if we have good rain events and it floods the floodplains, there's lots of food up there, and so they'll just go up and kind of gorge themselves and get really fat, and they don't mm-hmm. come down until those floodplains start to recede
mm-hmm.
and they're forced down the river. Sturgeon is an example yeah. of a fish that is also urohaline, and it goes back to those freshwater environments to spawn. Yeah. And of course, the only reason why we have the only place we have sturgeon is like the Suwannee River and the
Chuckalowski, it's one of those
up north rivers that I can't pronounce. It's because they're not dammed. So most of our rivers are dammed, and they can't get to where they need to spawn. But that would be another example of one that...
Tarpon or freshwater.
Tarpon can absolutely live in freshwater. And tarpon and snook, interestingly, in their juvenile stages, can live in really oxygen-poor environments.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where they kind of seek out to be, where, like, redfish seek out those high turbid areas. Snook and tarpon seek out these, like, real back bay waters that have lots of tree cover
Brown.
That's kind of stagnant, that doesn't have a lot of oxygen, but they have, like, mosquito fish and mollies mm-hmm. and insects, mm-hmm. and they're protected from other things eating them,
mm-hmm.
and they can... At that point, they can tolerate these low oxygen waters, but at some point they get big enough to where they have to move out because they need bigger prey items. Their snook is losing its ability to be in the low oxygen waters, and that's when you start seeing them come back out into the estuary proper. They'll come out and hang out in the...
Charlotte Harbor is so special, because it's that estuary. And so... I have forgotten the numbers, but it was something like Florida has like 27 estuaries, and out of that, Charlotte Harbor has like 12 of them or something.
Are you talking about aquatic preserves?
Just the estuaries themselves.
Because I think it's much higher than 27.
I don't remember the numbers.
Well, yeah.
So Charlotte Harbor, I mean, if you want to break it down, we have Lemon Bay. There's Gasparilla Sound.
So these are all estuaries?
Yep, Charlotte Harbor proper. You have the Myakka River Estuary, the Peace River Estuary, Matt Lachey Pass, Pine Island Sound, San Carlos Bay, mm-hmm. and then the Caloosahatchee Estuary.
And then some people
will also consider Estero Bay to be attached to Charlotte Harbor.
Yeah.
So it just depends on where you draw your boundaries, too.
See, we're not just another body of water out there, like babies like us.
Yeah, and they're all very
like us. So babies here.
We do make lots of babies.
I think that's why a lot of us are so protective of our waters and mm-hmm. our grasses and our harbor, is just because it's because of that. It is an estuary, and I think it's, thank you for defining that so people know how important it really truly
is. It explains a lot. It really does. There's a spot in Matt Lachey. It's actually behind D&D Bait and Tackle, and it used to be a dam there. I mean, a boat lift.
Okay.
And it blocked off the freshwater canals, they call the spreader canals, that go into Cape Coral, which is freshwater.
Yeah.
Right? So they had the lock there. That lifted the boat over.
Right.
Obviously, the water from Cape Coral made its way around, because it's mangroves. So, I mean, it's not 100% blocking the water. So, obviously, there's some getting into the freshwater. But right there, when I was a kid, I used to be able to go out in the spreader canals and slaughter the bass. Now you can go right to that same spot, and you don't know if you're going to catch a snook or a bass.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I'm serious, and it's it's clear. There's no salt in that water whatsoever. It's brackish.
Okay.
At times, but there's no salt in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering why and how in the world did this snook make it up the spreader canals and out into the freshwater and hanging out with the bass.
Right.
So now I know I've seen that.
Shell Creek is the same way. You can go up Shell Creek and not know if you're going to pull out a tarpon, a snook, a bass.
For all you out there, that is the best snook hole you can go to.
And what's interesting is not all snook will go into the fresh areas. It's like a certain, certain ones seem to know, like, life is good up here. Yeah. I think I'll go hang out. I guess it's, you know, I always equate them to people, and I know fish are not people, but, you know, like, you know, some of us kind of like to hang out down at the coast and others, you know, in other places. I suspect fish are kind of the same way.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So snook likes fresh water.
Snook.
They do.
Yeah.
So that's why we can go out to Arcadia right now, and we can still bring snook home, even in the closure, because they are a freshwater fish. So, yeah, that's the beauty of it. We still need that snook stamp.
Makes a lot of sense, see?
Still need that snook stamp. Yep.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Because I think there's, like, trouble with bringing it across
the line.
Yeah.
Well, and we had talked about that, taking a picture right there at the DeSoto County line.
She did a video. Betty actually did a video.
Okay.
I believe it was either you or the Shark Brothers.
Ah, yes.
Did a video about, I think, I'm pretty sure it was. It was about the scallops, right?
I've done two videos with
them. The certain area up northern panhandle, say.
Uh-huh.
That was the scallop season. But down here was not scallop season. And that you had to be careful of taking scallops out of there. And
right. Yeah, so where you can only land scallops. I think they may have changed that a little bit this year, though.
Yeah.
I mean, they're always tweaking, but at that point, you could only land scallops in a county where you could harvest scallops. And I believe the same is true for snook. So you can only harvest snook in DeSoto County.
I have a grill small enough to take on the boat.
Man, I mean, that's...
So harvest means what?
Taking it out.
Yeah.
Or so be in possession. You can't be in possession of a snook you caught in DeSoto County in Charlotte County. Like, in your boat. You have
just have to go up there, catch it, cook it, and come home.
So I can't go up there and catch them and come back with it.
I think you can land it. You can land it in your car. You know, you can land it in DeSoto County, put it
in
your car.
But you just can't be on the water with
it. You can't, like, traverse through Charlotte County.
Oh, okay. So you can drive it back home.
I believe so. That's the consistent with scallops.
Well,
that's consistent
there, right?
With lobster. It's the same way.
Well, it's legit there. I mean, it's legal up there.
Right.
So I don't see why you couldn't take it.
Yeah, you just can't take it across that county line by
water.
But
if you get pulled over in Charlotte County by the random FWC officer that pulls you over for... because he can, and he sees that you have a snook in your cooler, how...
Yeah,
I mean, I think that's a chance that you take. I wouldn't even want to. Yeah.
Yeah, I would not want to push.
I'm not losing my boat over a snook.
I'm all for, like, pressing your luck, but that's.
The penalties are high.
I mean, if you have GPS on your boat, then, you know, you can kind of demonstrate that you were there because you have this track.
Oh, yeah, or now our phones.
Right. And we talked about taking pictures.
I mean, would that be legit or not? I mean, because.
I think that's part of that gray area. I'm not even sure that there's really. Again, I ain't losing my boat over it. I mean, some of them penalties can be pretty tough.
Your fishing license, too, right?
Yeah.
It just, you know, sometimes the gray area
depends on the judge, you know.
Comes down to how they interpret and, you know, which officer you got that day.
Yeah, we had a whole episode on that.
We did.
The gray area.
We did, yeah.
And my opinion, of course, is say what... No, how does it say? Say what you mean what you say?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It's either the red
just
was,
tell
the light
yes
was red
or no.
officer or the light was green officer.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's no in between
there. Still yellow.
You know what I mean? There's
it
no
was
in between
orange.
There, you know? I saw the speed limit sign. It said 55. Yeah, you were doing 70. Well, that's, you know...
Within a margin of error.
Yeah.
We're grading on a curve.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Solidifies my thing.
Right. Exactly. So anyhow, we were talking about the redfish. So where did you say I can catch redfish? I'm sorry. You told me the big bull reds.
Oh, you're trying to get a fish.
Yeah, so where have you studied the most redfish?
Now, did I say you all are the expert?
I thought you said
I was the expert, not Jeannie.
I'm learning from D. So we had spoken briefly about how redfish grow up here and then move offshore.
Yes.
So can you tell us again a little bit about that and how long they stay in here and why exactly they stay in here and then why exactly they move offshore and why Louisiana, I guess, has more than we do.
So we have... we're the nursery area for redfish in our geographic area, and redfish will stay in the estuary until they're about 3 to 4 years old, and then they move offshore. And when they move offshore, they join schooling groups, and so they'll school up and down the coast, and they spawn off of various passes, mm-hmm. and then they just kind of go back. Some of them are associated with structure, so one of the ones that I had tagged showed up off of Naples on structure at a tower that's down there. It was 70 miles offshore.
That's awesome.
It was so freaking cool.
That is awesome.
70
miles offshore. My little kid's cup redfish showed up like 2 years after we tagged it, and it would have been the right size to be offshore with this adult population. And it was awesome. Moving in and out of the array, so we knew it was, like, not dead. Yeah. And it showed up over a several-month period, so we knew it wasn't like it got ate by a dolphin and, or a shark or something.
Swimming around, shark
because dog. It would have went out, what goes in must come out. Unless you surgically implanted it, then So we were very confident that this was our redfish, and it was still awesome. Out there swimming, which was really cool. As far as, so we know that off of Louisiana, that kind of northern part of the state, habitat's different there. They have a lot of salt marsh. I mean, just a ton of salt marsh. And redfish really like salt marsh. There's a lot of food for them in there. You've got that big Mississippi River that's bringing in lots of... nutrients that's providing a lot of productivity for a lot of small things. Shrimp.
Yeah.
I mean, shrimp, that's a major shrimping ground. Shrimp-like salt marsh in their early life cycle. And so there's just a huge amount of food for redfish in that area of the state that we just can't compete with. And, it's just a function. We have mangroves. They have salt marsh. So there's more juveniles to produce more adults. I don't know enough about the adult population to know how far those adults are moving. I did read a study one time, and you didn't tell me the questions ahead of time, so I don't remember what the results were. As far as what the travel patterns were on those big bull reds, whether or not they're coming this far south. I almost want to say I remember there being distinct populations, whereas, some of the ones that were up there kind of migrated up there back and forth, and the ones down here migrated back and forth down here. Hmm. And they were distinct, but I don't...
Yeah, so I'll give you my phone number if you can text me the coordinates of where they go exactly.
Well, if you catch them, you can't keep those ones offshore. They're like safe.
I don't keep any of them. I just want to catch them.
You just want to catch them. Okay.
Wait, what was that?
There's no harvesting of
redfish
offshore.
Yeah.
And bull reds. Yeah. I mean, you can 28 like inches safe. Here.
Yeah. That's funny.
They're like, can't keep me.
Right. But I can catch you, so I'll be looking forward to the coordinates.
All I know is it was some tower. Beyond that, I mean, they're moving.
They got fins, right?
Yeah. They're moving.
They go.
All right, I have one question. You gotta ask somebody that targets them, because that's beyond the scope of my knowledge.
I just lost my train of thought.
Oh, that happens to me all the time.
Finally got it all together, and I forgot where I put it. Yeah. Snook. It was probably about snook. Mm. Your big 30-inch snook. 40-inch snook.
Big redfish.
Crack. How big does a redfish get out in the Gulf?
How big?
Yeah.
So, large. Massive. But once they go offshore, they stop, you know, they grow, they still continue to grow, but they grow less lengthwise, where I mentioned, you know, like
half an inch to an inch
in the first year, then it's like half an inch. Once they move offshore, they're growing less lengthwise and more girthwise.
Okay. They get real pretty. Yeah. Real pretty. A lot of fun.
Like dark
like
red, too.
Big tackle.
Yeah. All right, I remembered my question.
Ah, okay.
You call salt marsh. Is that like salt flats? What's a salt marsh?
Salt marsh is like cordgrass or black needle rush, like the, I don't know.
And those,
it's just like, what, maybe 5-6 foot high. We have it in the Peace River.
Yeah.
So it's that marsh grass.
Oh, okay. Because, like, on a Pine Island, there's salt flats.
Which has, like, kind of nothing, right?
Yeah, they're, like, nothing grows on it. But on the outsides of them, when they touch the water, there's mangroves that grow on the outside.
Yeah. Now, what I'm thinking of is this the marsh vegetation.
Oh, okay.
So it's this, you know, once you start getting north of Tampa, you start losing mangroves, and the salt marsh plants kind of take over that area that here mangroves have a foothold.
And these plants produce salt? I mean, where does the salt
I think it's just because these plants can grow in salt, we would consider them to be a salt marsh as opposed to, because you can have freshwater marshes as well.
Right, right.
So it's just, you know, a marsh is anything that has herbaceous plants, and these are salty ones.
Hmm. So it doesn't really have anything to do with the water salinity, it's just the plants that grow in salt.
Yeah, so, you know, certain plants have the ability to grow in salt. And these ones happen to have the ability to grow.
And marshes, when you say the word marsh, I mean, that really dictates skinny water. I mean, at least in my mind, that dictates skinny water. And then when you have skinny water, say in the wintertime, of course, your salinity level is going to be higher because we have less freshwater rain. So am I logically, in my mind, that's where I would go with that. Am I thinking that correctly?
Is the fishing
way
better?
Off base?
Is that what you're trying to say? When we have less rain?
Well, I'm just trying to define the whole salt marsh thing and how we would say it would be a salt marsh. So I'm thinking more salt because higher salinity level with skinnier water would make that salinity level higher.
There's different salt marsh plants, like black needle rush, for instance. Some people call it juncus, which is the scientific name. That can grow in pretty fresh water, so it doesn't have to have like high salt. In fact, it prefers low salty water. Whereas, I'm trying to think what the other one is, it's the cordgrass. That has a pretty wide salinity range. So, I don't know that it's necessarily the salt. I mean, certainly these plants are adapted to salt, and then they have a footprint that they're able to grow in.
Do we have salt marshes here in Charlotte Harbor?
We do. So, well, we have them in the Peace River.
Okay.
So, if you go up the Peace River, you see all those marsh plants that are maybe, 4 or 5 foot high?
Yeah.
That is black needle rush.
Okay.
On the outer edges of it, sometimes you get smooth cordgrass, and sometimes you see smooth cordgrass, like I've seen it over in Lemon Bay, right just south of the Tom Adams Bridge. There's that little island, and it grows all the way around that island.
Which is really weird, because we're talking about a lot of fresh water here. So we're calling salt marshes and fresh, like, way up that high past Tippecanoe itself is a lot of fresh water. So going up to where you're speaking of is significantly freshwater.
But it still has saltwater influence in the wintertime?
Brackish.
Yeah.
Yes.
So in the summertime, I mean, you can have, it can be fresh way out in the harbor, but in the wintertime, that salt water can move up into DeSoto County.
Mm-hmm. So that word, I guess the term salt marsh can be a little bit deceiving in the way that you think it's
salty. I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't necessarily mean salinity water.
Yeah.
It just means things that grow in.
Yeah, it can grow in salt water. I mean, to think about mangroves, we think of mangroves as being saltwater plants, but mangroves can grow in freshwater too.
Yes.
So it's just plants that have adaptations that allow them to exist in saltwater environments. And most plants do not have those adaptations.
So are salt marshes up the Peace River?
Salt marshes will go up somewhere into DeSoto, or, you know, the lower part of DeSoto County, and then it's going to transition into your freshwater, true freshwater vegetation.
I have never fished for redfish up that country up there.
And where does it transfer at?
Somewhere the salt marsh that habitat somewhere up the Peace River around DeSoto. Because we certainly have it still up around Liverpool, which is in DeSoto County.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, how much beyond that I can't visualize it now, but, you know, at some point you're getting into where it's true fresh water and your vegetation is changing. So you would expect the same type of vegetation that you would see on Shell Creek up above the dam.
And again, it's our rats or our bulls that like the salt marshes? Or both?
The rats.
Okay. So that's where they want to grow up
the
is in a salt
marsh. The bulls
are
still offshore.
And then the bulls are going out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can say I've never caught a redfish offshore. Never.
No, I haven't either. I mean, they're there.
But that's the big ones, right?
So yeah, that's the big ones.
You got to get a bigger boat.
I've seen it. I just don't go I just don't go offshore a lot. I'm still trying to stir up the algae at the bottom of our turtle grass.
That's funny because my husband's like, you went through 3 trolling motors in the past 5 years. And like, one motor.
Yeah.
We need a bigger boat.
We were talking about snook earlier and how snook get to a certain point and then they change genders and then they go out and they spawn. Can we talk about that again?
Yeah, we can talk about whatever you want.
Yay. So, Alex.
Hello.
Okay, there you are. So I know that we were on this conversation earlier, and I know it was an interesting one, but I can't really remember exactly how we got there. Help.
So the first question I asked was, at this time of year, we really only get peewee shrimping, and I was wondering if a snook would be more apt to bite on a peewee shrimp because that's what's around, or would they be interested in a random, you know, hand-picked shrimp, which at Fish and Frank's is a large shrimp. And you had mentioned that snook tend to eat 14%
of
their body weight. So it really...
You need to get them a bigger
shrimp. So based on our... doing gut content analysis, in the summertime, snook tend to cue more into pinfish than they do snook, whereas in the wintertime, they cue more into shrimp than they do pinfish because the size that they're after are more available in those species at those different times of the year.
Yeah, that's in the summertime, we sell way more pinfish than we do.
Yeah, so they're a bigger size. So pinfish spawn in the late fall. The larvae come into the estuary. They settle out at, you know, in January, February. They're only like maybe half an inch to an inch in size.
Yeah.
They're much too small. There's a lot of them, but they're much too small for snook to be interested in.
Another question I had was about the lateral lines. I know that snook have ears. What's the difference between the information that they're getting from their lateral lines in comparison to what they're getting from their ears?
So what snook are getting from their ears, and this is basically the ear stone, it's their sensing density differences because the ear stone is made of calcium carbonate, so it's the only like real solid structure in a snook. Everything else is full of water and fluid. And so as vibrations move across,
except
it kind
for
of
their
just
extra
like
bone.
It just gets like stuck on that, and it sends a different signal about size and stuff. But they also use those ears to orient themselves. So it helps them with balance. The lateral line.
I'm sorry, was that the oculus?
The otolith.
Otolith. I was close, dang it. Okay.
So close. So the lateral line, which is actually a system, it allows water to flow. The water flows across the fish, and if you look at the lateral line or along the head, along the trunk to the tail, you'll see it looks kind of like pores.
Yeah.
Okay. And within each of those pores is a bundle of hairs, and as water flows across the head, or as there's fluid that's actually inside the lateral line, as different things push along the water, it creates it forces the hairs over. Mm-hmm. So the hairs push over, and that sends a signal to the brain, which, because those hairs are connected to nerves,
yeah,
and the nerves go to the brain, mm-hmm, and it tells the fish, and that was not a very good explanation, but it tells the fish pretty much, you know, something's there, it's about 4 foot away, it's about this size, and so they're getting these external cues based on water movement or pressure that's being caused by water that's moving.
I ain't gonna lie, I think you've just totally blown my mind. Are you telling me that, okay, by lateral line, I'm assuming that you're talking about the black line that goes down the side of a snook?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's actually useful? That's not just a... I thought that was... Really?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yes.
I thought that was just a...
So, like, fish have like a sixth sense, you will. So that's, mm-hmm, that's really important. And what a lot of people don't realize, mm-hmm, is not just the line, but there's also a lateral line mm-hmm, pores, if you will, that are on the head. And you can see them on certain fish species really prominently.
They look kind of like nostrils.
Yeah,
right?
But there's a
head,
whole bunch of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some they'll go down the trunk and sometimes at the base of the tail. Uh-huh. Not, you know, every fish species has a different lateral line. Some are more functional than others. Mm-hmm. But they use that to sense their environment. So
we know that
slight little pressure changes in the water tells a fish information, and that information is processed by the brain to say, hey, you are, 3 foot away from
a human.
Something that's small and might be tasty.
Yeah. Well, so obviously this lateral line is super sensitive, correct?
It is very sensitive.
Is it more sensitive in the snook rather than another fish?
I don't think so.
Because, especially the snook down at the dock, I'm trying to get him there. And he's like, he's playing dirty with me. even when you go fishing for snook, they're very skittish fish.
Right.
You got to sneak up on them,
Right. Certainly there are fish that have lateral lines that are more sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
The snook
isn't
one of them?
I don't know that snook is one of them. It could just be, that the lateral line is a color, but I have asked that same question, and I have never gotten a confirmation on that.
Yeah.
So, could still be a mystery question. It could be, but it's not something that I've found conclusive.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. We know that snook are super, I say super smart, but maybe it's because their senses, they can see really well, they can hear really well, and now we have this lateral line where they can feel really well.
Yeah, the lateral line.
So it's just another one of their senses that helps them out, basically, is what it...
Well, and, mm-hmm, think about schooling fish. Mm-hmm. Like any of your sardines.
Snapper?
Or
is snapper one of them?
Yes.
Finger snapper?
To some degree.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of like some of the bait fish in particular.
Oh, like panfish and greenbacks.
So, they're using both vision and their lateral line to school.
Yeah.
So they're sighting, like I'm sighting off of you, and I'm trying to keep the same distance and speed, but yet my lateral line is also telling me
I got you.
How to stay in the school.
That's exactly like when you're on the bow of the boat and you're throwing that cast net to get that white bait. And, I mean, all of a sudden they're coming at you, and all of a sudden they go,
yes.
And then the big balls that you see off, you see them in the, like, Animal Planet, but, like, Blue Planet or whatever, the big bait balls. It was on Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
They would turn one way, and they would make the flash, and it's just weird to me how they all knew, like, turn left now.
Turn right now.
Go straight.
This is kind of off subject, but you know what? Another one that I realized does the same thing is a fiddler crab.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
They kind of do all move together, right?
They do.
And
they do.
Punches.
Yeah, I don't know what their mechanism is. I don't think they have a lateral line, but they certainly have some kind of communication.
Because I know...
Fiddler crabs are so cool.
They are. I love them.
They are really neat, yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, when you stand on the bow of the boat with the cast net in your mouth, you're like, get them. And then
and
all of a sudden,
ball.
There's like hundreds, and then all of a sudden they're like,
over there.
And then it's like, no, back over there. Like,
Well, that
makes sense.
It's a lateral. I had...
And sight.
All my life, I have no clue.
So scientists just learned that they always suspected that the lateral line was involved in schooling. But they had done these experiments I can just picture this, where they had, like, snipped the lateral line temporarily. I don't know how you temporarily snip a lateral line, but they had somehow disconnected the lateral line, and it didn't prevent schooling. So they assumed that the lateral line didn't have anything to do with it. But then when they found out that they had to, like, if they somehow made the entire system incapable... So the head part and the line, they were no longer able to school.
Oh, wow.
But yet they also know vision is important and that they cue into their nearest neighbor. So it's the two of those things together that seem to... And the other thing that's cool is you never see schooling fish at night because they need to be able to see the person next to them. So they'll kind of they might shoal and, you know, we have, like, loose aggregations, but they can't keep a close school. They can't see them.
That's true. I've never caught bait at nighttime. that's a fact.
Yeah, they all go down.
That's a fact.
And that's probably why, because they can't school. Their strength in numbers. They're bait fish.
Especially on the night where you get a full moon and it's slick calm out there. You can see everything. You know, I don't ever remember seeing any bait out there.
No flipping. Yeah, you're right. So I really always thought that black line down a snook was just for basically visual purposes, just for prettiness.
Well,
I had no idea.
The black color is probably visual.
But it outlines
the lateral line. You're absolutely correct. So, I mean, you know, all fish have a lateral line. Not all of them have that prominent black pretty stripe. And why snook have that black pretty stripe... you know, they're one of the few fish that do. The only other one that I can think of is what's that little catfish that gets in the little bottles?
Oh, don't talk about catfish.
Those, yeah, I was going to say, I don't know shit about a catfish.
It's the little freshwater one that looks like it's got like an eel.
Alex, you know freshwater catfish?
No, I'm stumped.
Oh, it's a tiny little one. They hurt like heck, though. They like to hang out in soda cans and stuff. They have
it's
like
a catfish?
Yeah, and it's got like a... like a tadpole tail.
It's
probably like a tadpole catfish. I don't know. I can't
remember.
Mad
really Toms. Cool.
Mad Toms.
Oh.
Mad Toms.
They have a real prominent stripe, too.
Can we talk about that?
Well, I have one more question about the snook lateral line. I seen a picture of a snook that the lateral line was broke in half.
Uh-huh. I've seen some of them before, too. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It kind of had a line coming off the head like this, and then the one coming from the tail went like this.
Yep.
And they didn't connect.
Does that mean he swims in circles?
It probably had gotten an injury at some point in its life that healed.
Yeah.
You know, the lateral line is probably still functioning. Remember, the black is probably just color.
Right.
As long as the lateral line system. But that system is actually, I mean, I always kind of equate it to you have, like, right under those pores is kind of like a stream, and then under that is, you could think of it like groundwater. Mm-hmm. And so the groundwater is the nerves, and the stream is this fluid, and then somewhere in the middle is this bundle of hairs.
Yeah.
And so you have all of these bundles that are kind of connected. And so as long as that fluid path and the nerve path is still intact, then they're okay. You know, but
so do we really know exactly what that lateral line does? Because you said perhaps schooling, but you said schooling is a lot of visual purpose too.
Well, we know
senses, right?
Yeah, it's senses.
But
it's,
what kind of? Oh, you so, said distance from something.
Yeah, so it's sensing. It's sensing. Okay. You know that there's something. It can sense. You know whether it's moving or not. What size it is.
I gotcha.
How far away it is.
Real quick.
That's awesome.
I think we're coming to the end of the show, but real quick, can we talk about the Oculus? Oculus? Did I get it?
Oculus?
Oh, gosh. That thing! Can we talk about that again? No, you said something really interesting earlier about you could cut into the fish from a scientific standpoint. You could cut into the fish, put that underneath a microscope, and then what?
And then you can age the fish. So fish produce, they have ear stones, which are made of calcium carbonate. So every day they're laying down a layer of calcium carbonate. In the summer months, they're actively growing, so they're laying down more calcium carbonate than they do in the wintertime. So those bands are wide and narrow, wide and narrow, wide and narrow. When a fish dies, you can actually remove that otolith. You can slice it and put it under a microscope and count the rings like and age a fish just like you age a tree.
That's awesome.
How about...
So that's awesome. How scientists know how old a fish is.
That's really cool,
through the otolith.
Do we know... I'm sorry.
So I know that you can also find otoliths in the stomach of fish from the fish that those fish have
yes,
eaten.
Yes.
Do those otoliths stay in the, let's say, snook's stomach for the rest of its life, or do they eventually break down?
They're like kidney stones?
Yeah, exactly.
not always. But you can actually tell what a fish has eaten based on otoliths, because every otolith is slightly different. And believe it or not, there is a otolith library that scientists will use when they're doing gut contents to see what fish species they've eaten. And the other thing that's really cool is scientists can tell where fish have been based on otoliths, because as they're laying down the calcium carbonate, they're picking up elements from the environment that they're in. And some are very unique to that environment, so they can say, like, you know, when this fish was 4 years old, it was in this environment, which is really cool.
That's pretty neat. So
that's
can I
really cool.
just ask, what is the oldest snook you've seen?
I've seen, or the records?
Okay, both. Let's do both, yeah.
I don't know the oldest snook that I've seen, but I think the records, the oldest age snook on this coast is somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 18 years.
Okay.
But scientists think that they probably lived like 30, 40 years old.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Okay. And you said we've got a couple minutes left?
2 minutes.
Okay. So what, when they spawn, how old are they? I'm sorry, when they turn from male to female, how old or what length is that?
So usually, I mean, it's kind of in the, let's say, 3 to 6 year range is when the majority of them are shifting. Not all males are going to transition to females. A certain percentage of them will be males for life, but the majority, at least on this coast, again, and there's some differences on the East Coast, but the majority of them are going to transition in that span. And so when they're about 5 years old, there's kind of an equal, like at a certain size, there's an equal percentage of males to females.
Why do you reckon it's different on the East Coast? Is it a habitat difference? Is it what?
I think it's a habitat population difference.
Okay.
So, you know, fish are going to transition based on need. And the needs
supply
are
and
different.
Demand.
Yeah, and the needs are different over there. I mean, that's true for
that
any fish
sense.
That changes sex. You know, groupers also change sex, and it's kind of the same way. You know, only a certain number of them are going to change to maintain that male-to-female ratio.
That's okay.
Awesome.
And so the males are smaller, the females. So the smaller males spawn with the larger females.
Yes.
Real quick, one last question. What's your favorite animal, your favorite plant?
Oh my gosh. Favorite plants, definitely orchids.
Okay.
I can kill favorite one of them.
Animal.
In a New York
minute. I don't know that I have a favorite animal.
Wow. Well, yeah, you know, I could understand that.
There's
being
so
a
many
hard
cool
question.
Ones.
Hey, what
I'm
do you
not
know about
sure
dolphins?
I know a thing or two.
Do you? Oh my! Did you hear that?
If we could do a whole. Another
did you hear that? I heard that. Yeah. Favorite animal. Favorite animal.
Seahorse. Polar bear.
No, I'm thinking like something like a crab. I think crabs are cool. I don't know.
Blue crab. Fiddler crab.
Well, fiddler crabs are really cool, too. Yes. I mean, you know, just the whole reproductive cycle of a fiddler crab is just
that is not where I was going with that.
I'm all about sex and animals. Yeah.
That's why we need to talk about the dolphins again.
No. Oh.
All right. Right? Well, that's all the time we have. This has been another episode of Fishy here? Radio.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us from me, Alex, D, Heather, Jeannie. And our guest Betty, thank you very much.
She wants to do it all the time, early in the morning,
awesome.
In the middle
you,
of the
you're welcome.
Night.
A lot.
Good. Now she awesome. Can't get enough. Man, that girl sure loves to fish. Yeah, I know she loves to fish. Oh, 'cause I do too, baby.